This conversation was recorded in the summer of 2017. Tim's book, 50 Things That Made the Modern Economy, is available wherever you get your books from.
Tim, I want to start with a very famous quote that's attributable to Disraeli, which is there are three kinds of lies. There's lies, damn lies, and statistics. Now, how is it possible for a sort of layperson like me to spot statistical bullshit, particularly now we're post-truth?
It's a very depressing time, isn't it? I think the truth is that good statistical fact-checking, good statistical journalism looks a lot like just regular common sense or regular quality journalism. So if you're writing as a journalist, if you're or covering a statistical story, you actually need to do what a normal journalist should do, which is find out where this is coming from, what's the context, what's the trend, should we believe it, is there an alternative opinion, just helping people understand what's going on, which is actually what any good journalist should do. So I don't think adding the statistics necessarily makes it a totally different kettle of fish. But very often you can fact check yourself with pretty straightforward common sense. So you can say, okay, so-and-so's used this number. Do I know what is being counted? So, for example, if someone says, self-harm in American universities is now at 40%. 40% of American students have self-harmed. First thing you have to say, before you go, is that true? What's the trend? You have to go, what's self-harm? Till I know what is being counted.
Oh, okay, so you have to define.
I don't know anything. 40% of students have done something and I don't know what it is until I know what the definition is. And then I can start asking, is it true? What's the trend? Why is this happening? And so on. But very often we see statistical claims made. And actually the problem isn't the number. The problem is you don't even know what the number's counting.
That's very interesting because, of course, self-harm can encompass all sorts of things from the physical to, you know, psychological damage that inflicts. Or drinking too much is self-harm, isn't it? Willfully drinking too much or smoking too much weed or whatever it might be.
And in each of these cases, there are some statisticians or researchers or possibly spin doctors or public relations consultants. It depends. But in each case, somebody has come to a view of what this thing is. And they have a definition, and that's fine. And the definition is probably fine. But until you know what the definition is, until you know what's being counted, you don't know anything. Then you move on to, okay, is it up or down from 10 years ago or 20 years ago? Who is giving me this number? Why are they giving me this number? What was the method? Is it a press release or is it a serious peer-reviewed journal and so on? And most of this stuff is quite easy to find out. Quick Google search and you're there. If you want to find out the truth. I think the problem with post-truth is a lot of people don't want to know the truth. They'd rather believe what they want to believe.
You can't handle the truth, as Jack Nicholson famously said in a military costume. And maybe that's true. Maybe we sort of want to insulate ourselves from things that are uncomfortable.
Well, we certainly do. So there's a whole bunch of psychological studies now of confirmation bias and something called desirability bias, which is it believing what you already believed is confirmation bias, believing what you hope to believe, you wish was true, is desirability bias. So an example of desirability bias is in the week or two before Joe Cox was murdered, Leave were ahead in the referendum to leave the EU in 10 consecutive opinion polls. So at that point you go, looks like we might be out. I mean, not definitely, but we might well be out.
Yeah.
But if you then look at the betting markets, people were still betting 3-1 we'll stay in. And the political class in general, both in Europe and in the UK, was like, well, probably it'll be fine. Probably people will come to their senses. And there was this incredible wishful thinking and all these different ways in which you could discount these opinion polls. And then, you know, we voted to leave. And I don't think it should have been such a surprise after all those polls. Was it? But people reinterpreted it as like, oh, it was a big polling shock. Really?
Is that to do with... Because it seems to me that... The frontier at the moment, and Michael Gove talked about, you know, that we don't need to shiver. You are allowed. We're all allowed to do a slight shiver. But he said we don't need experts. And much as I disagree with that statement profoundly,
actually, he said. Sorry to interrupt. He said people have had enough of experts.
That's right. People have had enough.
And I think he's probably right.
He's probably right. So yeah, you're absolutely right to make that correction. There's a fundamental difference. He might think people have had enough, but we do really need them. But what's interesting about this idea of the intellectual elite and the rejection of that is that there's, and I can understand why, there's a ownership of truth is a very big thing now. You know, everyone wants, why should a statistician own the truth? Why should a politician own the truth? I want to own my truth. And I think that's where suddenly everything becomes atomized, and what one believes is the most important thing above and beyond what perhaps verifiable empirical evidence suggests.
Yes, I'm entitled to my opinion. Yes, but you're not entitled to your own facts, right? The facts.
That's it.
I can't remember who said it, but some clever person once upon a time. And even the facts are now contested, which is very worrying, but we've got to learn to deal with it. We economists, I think, were caught out a bit. Scientists, climate scientists, vaccine scientists, scientists who studied tobacco, they've been dealing with this for a long, long time. So climate scientists have been dealing with this since the late 70s, early 80s, the politicization of truth. And we economists, I think, have only just caught up to the idea that it's not enough just to speak slowly and clearly, and if people didn't understand, just say it again or explain it in a different way. If people don't want to believe you because it threatens their identity, threatens their membership of a political tribe, if they think that you're lying to them, it doesn't help to explain things very clearly. You have to take a totally different approach. And the scientists, I think, are particularly climate scientists, well ahead of us on this.
Because no one wants to hear the planet is dying. So it doesn't fit my fantasy of we're all going to live forever in this green and bountiful universe.
Well, so, I mean, some people don't want to hear it, but nevertheless have accepted it.
Yes,
but in the US in particular, which is kind of important because they're one of the largest global emitters after China. In the US, a lot of people simply don't believe it. They think it's a plot. They think all the climate scientists don't really know anything. And that is highly tribal. It's political. And what's really weird about that is you assume, well, at least if we give people more information, that will help. But actually, when you look at people's beliefs on climate science and other politicized issues like vaccines, gun control, look at people's positions on climate science. Republicans and Democrats who don't have much scientific literacy, they don't really disagree. They have quite similar views. But Republicans and Democrats who have high levels of scientific literacy are poles apart. So you tell people more about the issues and they just gain more facts and objections and references they can use to bolster their own arguments. So if we're processing information in a selective way, taking what we want, ignoring what we don't want, giving people more information can actually make the problem even worse. So we're just starting to deal with this, I think.
So in light of that, we're more homogenized. If you take it to a sort of, perhaps it's a logical conclusion, we'd be more homogenized and peaceful as a society if we knew less.
That's
a terrible thing to hear.
It's slightly depressing, and I'm doing myself out of a job as a public explainer.
It's over.
Of everything. Yeah, finished. So what is the solution then? There is some interesting research coming out of the Cultural Cognition Lab at Yale, a guy called Dan Kahan and his team. And they've been studying this sort of polarization. And they've got this new research out that says actually people who are curious don't exhibit this polarization. So people who are highly scientifically curious, they don't polarize according to left or right. And scientific curiosity is a different thing from scientific literacy. And of course, if you can teach people to be curious and you can encourage people to be curious, they will pursue things even that seem counterintuitive. Well, this scientist is telling me this stuff. I don't really believe that. But I love a good mystery. I love a counterintuitive result. I love a good surprise. So they chase it up. So if we can encourage curiosity, that's a possible solution. And it was funny. I was at a meeting of economists recently, basically beating themselves up and saying, we don't seem to be able to communicate. Nobody takes us seriously anymore. People used to think economists knew stuff. Now, the politicians...
You were like gods.
Well, maybe not, but we were like doctors, at least. Like, some people thought that we knew stuff. Now, no one takes us seriously. No one believes our forecast. Politicians don't listen to us. The public don't listen to us. What do we do about it? So having this conversation, and people kept saying, what we really need is a Brian Cox of economics. And I said, yeah, you do need a Brian Cox of economics, but you don't know what it is that Brian Cox is actually doing. You think that what he has is good hair and good special effects, and he talks really simply and clearly. But actually what Brian Cox is doing, which is the same thing David Attenborough does and Carl Sagan and all the great explainers, he's creating this sense of wonder.
Yes.
You really want to find out more. And so what we need in economics and in all kinds of public life, whenever we get these experts involved, is to get people curious, wanting to educate themselves. Then I think we might make some progress.
But I see, it's in my head, you sort of are the Brian Cox of economics.
I don't have the hair.
But it's not all about the hair. It's not all about...
It's partly about the hair, though,
isn't
about,
it? But it's for somebody
There's
like
a reason they keep me on radio.
I do a lot of my work on radio too. For me, it's great communicators are people who take abstract concepts and they ground them in a reality that is accessible for people who haven't, done an economics degree, or in the case of Brian Cox, a PhD in astrophysics, whatever. And that is your skill. I mean, I don't suppose I'd ever really considered the pervasive role that economics plays in my life until I started listening to people like you putting it clearly and simply.
Yeah, and I try, and there are other people like me who try. It's puzzling that we economists seem to find it so difficult because, I mean, no one questions why should you be interested in black holes and stars and dinosaurs? Everyone's like, well, they're interesting, but they're completely irrelevant to everyday life. What have dinosaurs got to do with everyday life? And yet people are still interested. Whereas economics is everywhere. It's all around us. All the decisions we make, all the decisions that get made on our behalf, the interaction with politics, you go into any shop, and all these decisions have been made around what's going to be displayed where and how it's going to be marketed and how it's going to be priced. It's absolutely everywhere. The quality of the jobs that we have or that we don't have. So it should be quite easy to make people feel that this subject is relevant. But we somehow struggle. I think we tend to switch to the abstract very, very quickly. That's our default mode as economists. Something abstract. Assume away any specific thing and let's draw a graph. And actually, I try to keep it specific if I can. Let's talk about an actual thing, an actual person, a story about a real human being or a particular piece of technology or something. Because if we keep it specific, then people are still engaged.
You say talking about a specific thing, you've written a great book, 50 Things That Made the Modern Economy. And I really love this book because you pick, as the title suggests, 50 things that are absolutely resonant in the public consciousness. And you use them as a sort of mechanism to discuss wider economic traits or ebbs and flows. And the first one that you describe is the plough. Now, you think of a plough, I can understand how that revolutionised or formalised agriculture. But for you, there was a really dark side to the plough. And it was like, my God, it's a symbol of my oppression.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is quite speculative, but still, it's an interesting piece of speculation.
I was furious by the time I finished reading it.
Sorry about that. So the idea is, once you switch to a plough-based society, plough's quite a gendered tool because you need big, strong arms and you're out in the field. So you get this real division of labour. Forget the hunting, gathering division of labour. You get this real gendered division of labour.
So before it's nomadic, so it's couples out to families and they're herding in the plains.
The idea. And now, so you switch to agriculture. The men are out in the field. They're ploughing. The women are at home.
Gossiping.
They're grinding grain. They're working really hard. There's evidence in skeletons from thousands of years ago of women with arthritis in their knees and in their feet because of all the kneeling they did, all the processing of grain. But then you start thinking, well, hang on. Suddenly I've got property. As a man, I own this farm. I own this land. I can hand it to my heirs.
Yeah.
Also, what's my wife doing at home? What is she actually doing kneeling down all the time? Is it grounding? What's going on? And suddenly,
if she's not grinding grain and she's got arthritis, that's a lot of other stuff she's doing.
So there's this theory that the policing of women's sexual activity and the idea that the men had to keep an eye on what women were doing and who they were sleeping with.
But you said the rise of misogyny and tyranny, and you've put that down to the plough.
Well, tyranny certainly. So because you need a surplus to fight out. So the plough generates an economic surplus, which you can store. You can put it in a particular place.
Yeah.
It's not true for every type of crop. But for the grains, which you harvest once a year and then you stick in a storehouse and you wait and you wait and you wait. Well, okay, I just need to get together a bunch of people with some swords, come over to your storehouse and announce that I'm levying a tax. That is not possible in a nomadic society. You can't really tax nomads because they're living hand to mouth.
Mm.
Whereas you can tax somebody with an annual harvest. So suddenly you've got this whole...
Because they have an acquisition. They have something upon which some, a tax could be levied.
Yeah, that's stored and that you can't really move it around. So cassavas you can keep in the ground. So if you want to tax somebody who grows cassavas, you have to go around and you have to dig up these cassavas one at a time. But grain is different. So grain allows this infrastructure of a military class, a ruling class, bureaucrats, people who levy taxes, priests maybe.
So it's time. It's not only the fact that there's an asset... But it's also, this is what I find interesting about economics, it's to do with how much time people have and when they're working and when they're not working. So once they've got the grain in the store, then they, as you say, there's time for them to go and ransack somebody else or to go and invent sort of structures in which to manage property, land, their relationships with other people.
Yes, because you've got this surplus, you don't need every single person to be farming all the time to create enough to eat. So now some people don't have to farm all the time. So what do? Well, they generally get up to mischief, start bossing other people around. Or maybe under the guise of the priesthood, they start doing astronomy and they start forecasting the tides, the flooding of the Nile. And then you start getting mathematics. And then once you start levying taxes, you start going, well, who's paid what? How much are they paid? Are they paid enough? So you start needing...
That argument is still going on today, yeah. Of course.
But you need... we wouldn't get very far with the argument without... some way of writing stuff down, some way of recording quantities. So then the challenge of managing this increasingly sophisticated society and increasingly sophisticated economy leads to the development of writing, which is one of the mysteries in the book that I discuss. So where did writing come from? It wasn't about love poetry. It wasn't about sending messages to distant armies. It was accounting. So accountants were the people who did the first writing.
And sometimes they're the most creative of all the writers.
I believe so. We economists, we envy the accountants for their creativity.
What we need is a Brian Cox for accountants to come and explain, well, it's been, yeah, where the magic money trees are.
Accountancy. Sorry, Leonardo da Vinci has these amazing to-do lists. On one of his to-do lists, we're like, oh, I need to learn from Maestro Luca. And Luca is Luca di Pacioli, who is the guy who literally wrote the book on accountancy. It's called Summa di Arithmetica Proportionalita e Logica, I believe. I've probably got mangled that completely, but I know I've mangled it completely. But it's basically all the maths that everybody knows. And it's this huge volume.
Is that that's the translation? All the maths that everybody knows? Yeah, I'd read that book.
It's something like, I think the translation is the total of all arithmetic, proportionality and logic, I think.
Amazing.
Huge, huge book. I think it's 700 pages. It's piggybacks off the early Venetian printing industry. Because Venice
all we know about proportionality in mathematics, part one.
Because there's this big print run. They print 2,000 copies, which is huge. But it's in the middle of that book, there is 20 pages on double entry bookkeeping. And that's and that turns out to be one of the most influential parts of this book. And Leonardo da Vinci's like, I need to get me some of this double entry bookkeeping. So, yeah.
What do you think of Leonardo da Vinci? You don't conceive of the man at the end of the day going, God, I've really got to balance those books.
One of the other things on his to-do list, he's got loads of things like, find out how it is that they travel on the ice in the Netherlands.
helicopter.
Yeah, but also, one of his items on his to-do list is draw Milan. Isn't that the most beautiful,
that is,
poignant?
Yeah.
Draw Milan. That's like, a to-do list.
Only he would have... The sort of belief in him that was possible.
Well, I don't know. I think actually my to-do list is full of stuff like that.
Just
incredibly brief things that I'm never ever going to get around to doing. I don't think Leonardo got around to drawing Milan. I think that's quite a human moment.
But I wouldn't even have the hubris to believe that it was ever possible for me. That's the difference between me and I wake up and it's just a joy that I've actually managed to get 2 feet on the floor and get myself out of bed. Stitch Fix is an online personal styling service that takes the work out of dressing well. If you struggle to find the ideal item of clothing, whether shopping on the high street or online, like my producer Dan, then Stitch Fix is here to help. Now, Dan, we've spent a bit of time together in a very small room while recording this podcast, and it's fairly obvious you need some serious help when it comes to fashion, even more than me. Now, how have Stitch Fix helped you?
So after filling in the online style quiz, which includes sizes and your budget, Stitch Fix sent out my first box.
So what did you get in your first box?
So I got a pair of really smart jeans, a pair of dark chinos, two shirts, one smart, the other more casual, and the jumper. And it was really surprising how well they all fit and match the style and the look I wanted.
And are you going to keep all the items?
In the end, I kept the pair of jeans, one of the shirts, and the jumper, which I really liked. The other items I sent back, which is really easy. You just put them into the pre-labeled post bag and drop that at the post office, and you're done. And I've got another box scheduled to be delivered in the new year.
To get started, go to stitchfix.co.uk/Sue. And the Sue, the reason I've said it like that, is in capitals. And fill in a short style quiz and tell us all about your personal style, budget, size and clothing needs. Stitch Fix will then set you up with a personal stylist who will send you 5 items of clothing, each hand-picked from a selection of top European brands, including established names and emerging designers. You get to try everything at home and buy what you love and just send back the rest at no cost. There's no subscription. You simply schedule your delivery when you want it. Get started with Stitch Fix today and support our podcast by going to stitchfix.co.uk/Sue. Remember that bit. Right now. That's stitchfix.co.uk/Sue. We'll then come to the gramophone. I'm a big fan of the gramophone. Now, the economic argument within this is it's... And in so many of the things you discussed, there's an element of luck and geographical happenstance that happens in a lot of these success stories. So the thing I loved about that, and that what's great about this book, is it's chock full of these brilliant, as you say, personal examples, is the earlier phonograph. And I had no idea that you could only make a certain number of copies, two or three or something.
Mind-blowing. It's like most people won't remember this, but when I was really young, I used to write stories on a typewriter, my mum's old typewriter, with carbon paper.
Yeah.
And carbon paper, people, CC, that stands for carbon copy. So there's this bit of paper you'd put underneath your first type sheet, and you could do it twice. And you type really hard,
yeah.
And the carbon punches through one or two sheets, and it makes, so you can type 2 copies or 3 copies at a time. Bewilderingly archaic technology. But that's kind of how the phonograph was. The original Edison phonograph was, you can sing, and we will live transcribe it onto wax cylinders, and we can do 3, maybe 4. And if you want more than 4 copies, you've got to sing it again.
So this is guy. So this is the African American singer George W. Johnson in 1890, who basically has to sing an entire day and sings himself hoarse,
yeah,
just to maybe pump out 200 records.
Yeah, and I think he did it day after day. It was incredible. The same song everyone wanted to hear, and it's not quite as impossible as it sounds, because most of those records would then go into jukeboxes, so people would be paying money to, they'd be in some public space, you'd pay to listen to a recording of the song, if you wanted to listen to a recording of the song, you go away and then someone else comes in and they pay to listen to a recording of the song, so you were reaching more people than you might think, but still, I mean, it's incredibly primitive. So it wasn't really a duplication technology in the way that the flat LP was, the vinyl album, which came later, and then at which point you can make as many copies as you like, and that changes things.
So there's a sense there that your global domination, your ability to disseminate your creative genius, is entirely limited to not only what technologies around at the time, but where you happen to be geographically and what access you have. And where does streaming fit into that?
Yeah, so this is, I mean, the point of the whole gramophone story is to make us think about how technology interacts with people's skill to produce their economic return. So people get paid for being good at something, but how much they get paid completely depends on the technology.
Mm.
So what we're doing now, recording a podcast, would have been totally impossible 20 years ago. You'd have to distribute it by cassette, which, I mean, I think there was some person who did that and he tried to get a patent on it. But so the rewards to the same activity, the same level of skill as a performer, vary wildly depending on the technology. And so I was trying to get people to think about that. It's not just the gramophone. It's not just streaming. It's everywhere. So whatever we do, whether we're journalists or taxi drivers or a investment banker, the returns that you're paid to your skill depend on the technology interacting with that skill. So what the gramophone did is made it possible for the top people to basically earn almost unlimited returns. You could reach as many people as you like. And suddenly, no one's interested in the 10th best opera singer in the world. Who cares? Whereas previously, the 10th best opera singer in the world could earn a good living. Now it's all, I just want the top one or two. Now, streaming to some extent reverses that because it just takes away the reward from being recorded. And it puts it back towards live performance, which is what David Bowie told us, I think, 20 years ago, 15 years ago.
Anything that David Bowie has ever said is, for me, the immediate stuff of legend.
So he said it's going to be like water or electricity. You just turn on the tap and it comes out. Well,
it was incredibly prescient, actually, for him to come out with that.
It really was. And he said musicians need to get used to touring because that's where the scarcity will be. The economics of touring are a bit different than they used to be because you have stadium rock and amplification and all this. But yeah,
and the way that the album now, the relationship between the album and the tour has changed, as you say.
Yeah, the tour used to be about selling the album. Yeah. Now the album's about selling the tour.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, in my business as a writer, book festivals haven't quite figured this one out yet, and I'm not sure authors have quite figured this one out. So you used to be, you appear at a book festival in order to sell copies of your book. And now there's this realization, well, hang on, maybe the book is the loss leader for giving a talk. And you're actually paid to give a talk about the book. The book itself, you kind of give away almost for free. And we're in this weird space in the market for writing and the market for authors and this book festival boom as to who should actually be benefiting when an author gives a talk. Is this something the author should give away for free? Or should the author be giving away the books and selling the talk instead?
Which leads on to another chapter, actually, about intellectual property, which I found,
Charles Dickens, yeah.
I'm sort of obsessed with Charles Dickens, and not in a, I don't venerate him like many people, partly because I was lucky enough to make a doc in which I uncovered his sort of real life, where he was a real, I think the technical term is shit. I mean, he was appalling to his wife, and he decided he didn't want to be with her, so he just, but he didn't want to leave the house, so he just got some carpenters to build a wall in the middle of their bedroom, which sort of segregated them.
That's the peaceful solution, isn't it?
It's really,
strong fences make for good neighbours, I think.
It's the changing rooms Robert Frost episode said. No one wants to come home to. But within that episode, there's again that kind of a sort of similar idea of who owns creativity and in whose hands does it rest?
Yeah. And so initially, the American Constitution was very clear on this, which is that we give patents and intellectual property to promote the arts. So the idea is we'll give you an incentive to invent things and to write novels and so on. Because you need that incentive, because otherwise someone will steal your stuff. Gradually over time, that interpretation has become more and more generous towards the owner of the intellectual property. So now there's intellectual property in plants. There's intellectual property
in plants.
Yeah, well, if you can patent a particular kind of seed. I think you can even patent the discovery of the use of a plant that's naturally occurring. I could be wrong on that. People have patented restaurant decor. Like, I've got this particular way of doing my restaurant up. Well, I mean, it sort of makes sense. You run the gourmet burger kitchen and then someone sets up another burger company that kind of looks like the gourmet burger kitchen but isn't. So
it's an extension of branding, I suppose, yeah, the way that their restaurants actually physically look.
Yeah, but the courts have been very, very expansive in their interpretation of intellectual property. And the argument that I make in that piece is that's probably gone too far. And so I go way back to Boulton and Watt. So James Watt, his business partner Matthew Boulton, they developed this superior steam engine. And then they lobby Parliament. Matthew Boulton's very influential. They lobby Parliament for an extension to the patent. And they sit there for several decades just suing everybody who tries to produce a better steam engine. And that's not how it's supposed to work in the way we view patents. The patent should have encouraged Boulton and Watt to profit from their invention. But actually, they just tried to shut everyone else down, and there was a real explosion in innovation in steam engines after the patent expired. Meanwhile, Boulton and Watt did just fine after the patent expired, because they were like, oh, I guess we'll better get on with making really good steam engines now and keeping our customers really happy. And they did really well. And
so competition is good, I mean, essentially, is what
Yeah, I mean, in you can certainly create an economic model whereby intellectual property is necessary. Probably the most straightforward example would be pharmaceuticals. Like, it was really, really very expensive to invent a new drug.
Yes.
And really very, very cheap to copy it.
Yeah.
So there's a case for a patent. But I think we've probably just extended these patents far too far. And the story of Dickens, so the story I tell is Dickens going to America because the Americans don't respect his intellectual property. So his intellectual property in his novels in the UK, but the Americans can just rip him off. And he immediately runs into trouble with all the newspaper editors in America who are dependent on ripping off British intellectual property. So they just go for him and they perform this tremendous character assassination, which would be impossible to imagine a newspaper doing today. And they really go for Dickens, and he has a miserable time and he goes home. But then about 20 years later, to get away from his wife, as discussed, he goes back to America. He decides he's going to do a lecture tour and try and cash in on the fact that he's one of the most famous authors in North America. He's never made any money from these books, but he can, like David Bowie, he's going on tour and he makes an absolute fortune, about $25 million in today's money.
Extraordinary.
Giving readings of Christmas Carol.
Yeah.
And he never makes any money from the books, but he does in the end because he makes money from the book tour.
And interesting is, as a personal code, that he kind of works himself to death because he's so, his sort of guilt catches up with him. So he goes away and he enacts, and people talk about seeing him live and he's sweating and he's so immersed in these performances. And he just, he pours his heart out on stage because he can't believe what he did to his wife, and you know, he took his children away from her, and he had this sort of, you know, he fell in love with a young actress, and he hid it from everybody, and he was involved in a train, all these terrible, like, disturbing things. He probably has sort of PTSD, and yet he's on stage, and he's the first, of course, great global celebrity. He was the David Beckham of his time. But nobody before him had that incredible universal cachet that he did. It was amazing.
Yeah.
But I didn't realise what joined the dots, and what was great about the story you tell in your book, and it highlights how important the economic necessities of it are.
Yeah.
Is how that happened, how people knew about him. And that's exactly as you said, because there was no intellectual copyright or property, intellectual property attached to his work, and that it could be parodied and copied and everyone would know who he was.
And he was incredibly grumpy about it, but it was probably fine in the end. Probably did him a big favour.
What if you were to pick one invention or one thing in sort of modern history that has changed economics, what would it be?
My favourite example in the 20th century, I think, is the barcode. It's not the most important, but it's just so overlooked. It's completely ubiquitous. And it really, the barcode made Walmart possible. So that's a big deal.
Yeah.
And Walmart, I think people underrate to what extent Walmart, the company, is responsible for economic integration between the US and China. Like, they're just Walmart buyers going over to these startup Chinese factories and saying, you know, we will buy 100 million of this thing. If you set up a factory, we will buy it. And that kickstarting the whole Chinese manufacturing boom.
So they then set up factories to accommodate US demand.
If your buyer is Walmart, you build a factory.
Yeah.
And that was all down to the barcode. But the other interesting thing about the barcode, there's a wonderful invention story about Joseph Woodland sitting on a beach and just dragging his hands through the sand and then looking at the ridges and furrows that his fingers have made as the sand passes through his fingers. But there's also this other story you can tell about the barcode, which is basically committee meetings, endless, endless committee meetings. Because when the US Grocery Association and the food manufacturers, when they were arguing about this, they realized it's a really big deal. There's a big sort of, well, we'll put the barcode on our stuff when you install the barcode scanners. And they're like, oh, we'll install the barcode scanners when you put the barcode on your stuff.
No, you pay.
Exactly. And the design of the barcode as well, how many digits. I mean, it sounds incredibly boring, is incredibly boring, but they realized the stakes were really high because this was going to change who was profitable in retail, what kind of business could make money. It made it much, much easier to have a really big box store.
And presumably codifying products as well is important. You know, you can, a product is instantly recognizable.
Yeah. And the later version of this is Jeff Bezos setting up Amazon, starting with books. And at the time, I remember thinking, there were comparisons that Amazon was worth more than all the bookshops in the world. And I thought, well, that's ridiculous. Of course, Amazon can't be worth more than all the bookshops in the world. But now you realize, of course it can, because it's not just about the books. But the books were a great start, because the books were something that it's actually very easy to ship. They're quite high value, and they're very easy to identify. Like, you know, there's, you know, books are book. You know which book, you know the author, you know the title, you can get the book. And there's no argument about, oh, maybe I want a slightly different version of this book, because they're a book is a book. So Bezos knew that that was what he wanted, where he wanted Amazon to start. That's not my favorite invention in the book, though. My favorite invention in the whole book is, when I was trying to come up with a 50, I was talking to all kinds of people and saying, what would you put in? And everybody said, Gutenberg press, movable type printing press. It gave us the Reformation, gave us the novel, the textbook, the modern scientific method, basically made Europe for the first time in human history, the center of civilization, the most advanced civilization in the world. It was the printing press. And I looked at it and I realized actually I wasn't going to do the printing press. I wanted to do something else. So when you look at the printing press, these original Gutenberg Bibles, some of them are printed on parchment, which is made of animal skin. But most of them are printed on paper, obviously. Of course, what else would you print them on? But it turns out that paper was quite a new development in Europe at the time. There was no demand for it initially because no one could write. So saying, I really want a cheap writing material for my amazingly expensive Bibles is like saying, I really want a cheap metal to make crowns out of. It doesn't make any sense. Why do you need? You don't need cheap crowns. You don't need cheap Bibles.
Because monks are writing on parchment, presumably. And
yeah, they're writing on parchment. But you needed 250 sheep for one Bible. It's really, really expensive. Now, to set up a printing press, you need a print run of maybe 2,000 books. So you do the maths on that. Mm. That's 500,000 sheep. It just doesn't work. The economics
of it. They don't fit into printing presses for a start. They're really messy.
So Gutenberg invented this way of mass producing writing, but it was completely pointless until there was a way of mass producing a writing surface. So paper came first. Paper underpinned it all. Paper was arguably Europe's first industry. And of course, we use it for all kinds of other things. You know, wallpaper, sandpaper, wrapping paper, toilet paper. And there's something very important, I think, about this invention. That there's something powerful about getting so cheap that you can wipe your backside on this thing, or you can print a newspaper and throw it away after 24 hours and buy another one.
Or
wipe your backside on it. You do both of these things. That's the kind of invention that I think doesn't get enough airtime. Everyone talks about the Gutenberg press. Of course, it's very important, but paper was important too.
The Gutenberg press is the sort of jazz hands, isn't it? It's the sort of look at me. It's the show. It's the showboater that's going, I'm responsible for X, Y, and Z. As you say, all these extraordinary things that followed. But yeah, I love the fact that paper's in there, because it's something you just wouldn't think of. And it's so, because it's so basic.
Yeah.
Because it's so common and utilitarian. It's brilliant.
This episode of the podcast is sponsored by HelloFresh. HelloFresh is the UK's leading recipe box service, delivering fresh, pre-portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes to your door. It's the easy, convenient way to cook delicious dinners from scratch. Perfect for anyone who doesn't have time to prepare their own meals or just isn't very good at cooking. You get to choose your favourites from 19 recipes every week, including rapid recipes which will be ready in 20 minutes or less. They offer family favourites, British and world cuisine, including beef kofta curry and za'atar spiced chicken. Following last week's Mexican-inspired chili non carne, this week I cooked Caribbean-spiced black bean curry with zesty quinoa. To sign up for your first box, head to hellofresh.co.uk, choose a box, a delivery slot, and add your favourite recipes. All their fresh ingredients come direct from suppliers, pre-portioned, so there's no food waste. There's also a great selection of veggie options. HelloFresh are offering our listeners £60 off 4 boxes. Visit www.hellofresh.co.uk and enter the code HOUR at the checkout to enjoy delicious dinners without the drama.
The one, I mean, I love lots of them, but I was very taken with the fact you put video games in there, not only because I play video games, not particularly well, but because there was something so fundamentally emotional and beautiful about that story.
Yeah.
And that the economic argument in that, that you posit at the end, is that you've got a sort of growing economy in America, and you look at healthy, able-bodied men and the young men, and increasingly they are not working and or they're part-time.
Yeah.
And the reason for that is that, it's brilliant, but is that in real life they could maybe be working at Starbucks, and in the virtual world they're Starship Commanders.
Yeah. So I first had this idea suggested to me by an economist called Ted Castronova, very interesting guy, who started measuring the GDP of online worlds like World of Warcraft. So people trade in these worlds.
Yeah,
and there's and there's a real exchange rate.
You need the internal economy.
Yeah, so he could figure out, okay, the people, not how much do people spend, giving money to Blizzard, or I think it's Blizzard who own World of Warcraft. It's they're buying and selling magic swords or gold coins, or often levels. Like you got a 10th level character. I've got money. I haven't got time to get to 10th level. I just want to buy your 10th level character, so you trade me the password. And in some games it's encouraged, in some games it's frowned on. But he was calculating the real world, the GDP of these online worlds, and found that the GDP per person was kind of quite a lot higher than African economies. So people were earning about $3 an hour. That's a lot if you live in Nairobi. And then, of course, it becomes globalized. So suddenly the people working in these digital sweatshops in China, and they're selling their time. So all of that was happening. And Castronova says, in this presentation to a bunch of us in Washington, a bunch of policy wonks, you guys think this is ridiculous. You think it's absurd to spend all your time in a game. But you guys are winning the game of life. Not everyone can win the game of life. But they can win in World of Warcraft. So he planted that seed in my mind. And then just earlier this year, a conference paper was presented by four economists who I think they're really good. They know what they're doing, documenting the rise in underemployment of American young men. It's specifically young, specifically men. It's not happening in older men. It's not happening in women. And making the suggestion that this is to do with computer games. And just at the beginning of July this year, they just published a working paper version of that. So I've been studying that. And yeah, they make quite a good case. Basically, the games are really good. They're really fun. They're really cheap. Life's boring. And so it seems that these young men have just decided they'd rather be playing games and literally living in their parents' basement. They've got all the data on this. And they're happy.
That's the thing, because the sort of trope of the sort of gamer is, that they've dropped out. They're dropouts. They exist outside of society. They actually just chosen a different world to inhabit, in which they are more in control. There's more flexibility, perhaps more creativity, more prestige.
Yeah.
But what's interesting is that the sub economy that sustains that, which is, as you say, you've got these digital sweatshops in wherever, Japan or Korea, where people are spending their real lives, kind of. In a game,
yeah.
Attaining a high level and then selling that on for maybe $10,000 to a guy who's maybe a banker who hasn't got the time,
yeah.
To become a great warlord in a video game.
It is amazing.
That blows my mind.
The ultimate commoditization of all this, yeah. And there's a
fantasy. I mean, it's a commoditization of fantasy of an alternate reality.
Yeah, and people can be very down on these games. I mean, I've been thinking about this. Just this week, because I've been reading this working paper and reflecting, my son is 5 and he just loves playing games on his iPad, yeah. And will kick up a tantrum if I stop him from doing that. And so I do worry about it, but at the same time, I guess it's like anything. So there's 50 Shades of Grey and there's Ulysses. You don't just say, oh, books. They're brilliant or they're rubbish. Yeah. Well, it depends.
I hate all books. Yeah,
yeah. And it's the same with games. And from the outside, we just perceive games, but actually there are terrible, mindless, addictive games. We model on slot machines, which are just designed to short circuit our dopamine levels and just get us clicking and clicking and clicking. And Ian Bogost, a sort of social critic and game designer, actually produced a parody of Farmville called Cow Clicker. where there are cows and you have to click on the cows. And if you click on the cows, you get more clicks. You can click on the cows again. But it was a huge hit. So the satire was kind of self-defeating. So there are these terrible games, but then there are also games that really connect us. I don't play computer games myself, but I play board games. I play role-playing games, play Dungeons & Dragons. It's one thing I have in common with Michael Gove.
Wow.
Just if you want to be put off Dungeons & Dragons. And some of the best friendships I have are with my old gaming group from 20 years ago.
Great.
I still hang out with them, not always to play games, but sometimes. So that's a real solid human connection that I haven't got from reading books, that it's come from the games.
But I think when you play games, it's good to take a beat and go, how is this benefiting me? So a friend of mine, I got into Minecraft, and I would spend hours, sometimes all night. But whereas I'd seen online and seen with other people playing Minecraft, people would build these palaces and they would jump into the clouds. I was underground all the time, and all I would do would repetitiously and religiously bore holes in the granite, endless tunnels. And then a friend said, "You're always underground because no one can see you." And I've spent so much of my... And it made sense to me.
Yeah.
I spend most of my working life, you know, some would say ineffectually and irritatingly, sort of being this huge peacock and look at me, I'm a fractured clown, love me. And when I go home, I want to be subterranean, doing something utterly mindless, but where I actually feel that I'm doing it for, you know, this look, I've discovered an ore, you know, and I've put it in a little chest.
It's quiet and soothing.
Yeah, and I might spawn an underground cow, a couple of cows. I might just sit with them for a bit. And it's peaceful. And for people that just say, I hate video games, it really annoys me because they have immense benefit to a lot of people for lots of different reasons.
So this is maybe one of these misattributed quotations, but I think Oscar Wilde said that wasted time is anything you feel bad after. and I think that's what we have to ask ourselves. You know, if you're playing a game or whatever, you're watching TV, whatever it is that you're doing, if after you do it, you think, oh, I wish I hadn't done that, I wish I hadn't spent the last 2 hours doing that, you wasted your time. But if at the end of the 2 hours you're perfectly happy, well, it's not a waste of time at all.
And also, the subconscious mind needs to waste time. If the conscious mind is sort of engaged in something relatively banal, whether it's, you know, digging tunnels or watching a bit of telly, then if you believe in that sort of flow theory of, you know, the underneath it all, problems are being solved and creative thinking is happening, it's perfect. You can't be on it or consciously on things all the time because then you burn out.
Yeah.
That's my excuse.
So, yeah, there are good games and bad games.
There are definitely good games and bad games. But I sort of thought, oh, brilliant, because I am... I grow sick of the sort of wanton generic demonization of anyone who plays a game as a wastrel, you know. I think sometimes they can be amazingly educational tools for kids, but also great distractions. And as you say in your book, who wouldn't want to be a Starship Commander sometimes?
Exactly so.
It's extraordinary. In fact, I'm keen. I don't know if you saw a Black Mirror hour on in which a character went around and she just complimented everybody, and the more she complimented people, the more they'd get on their phones and they would give her 5 stars. And it was this dystopian world where you got feedback, so it wasn't about genuine intimate friendships, it was simply about, and it was also tense because if somebody dropped something or you'd get negative feedback, and your overall score, whether it was a 4.2 or a 2.9, absolutely dictated your social standing.
Yeah.
And that, although it's a sort of an other world kind of extremity of what you talk about, seller feedback features in your book. And I really enjoyed that particular chapter. Because it's a cute, very... I didn't understand that so... But of course, it's obvious now I say it out loud, but that so much of modern economics is based around trust, or in fact economics in all eras actually.
Yeah, and it's a really interesting question as to how much the seller feedback is an important enabler of trust, or whether it's just a kind of permission. So there's this theory out there. So Cory Doctorow, science fiction writer and activist and so on, makes this. He basically says most people are decent people. So Airbnb works not because of seller feedback, because most people are decent people. eBay works because most people are decent people. Uber works because most people are decent people. But we need the seller feedback to kind of legitimize everything. There's this other view that basically says, no, people would really behave very, very badly if there wasn't some check. And the seller feedback, the customer review, the driver reviews the passenger reviews the driver. That's what keeps the system honest. I don't know who's right. I do know that trust in general is an incredibly important component of economies. And part of the process of economic growth and the modern complex economy has been finding ways to trust people you don't know. So people who aren't members of your family, you trust them anyway. You trust a stranger. So I go into a supermarket and I hand them a credit card and they give me stuff. It's not because they trust me. It's because they trust the credit card company, and the credit card company sort of trusts me because they know enough about me.
They've done the checks and balances.
That's how it all works. It's very important. So it's easy to get this very warm, fuzzy feeling about things like Airbnb. Oh, you're making a personal connection, and it's kind of back to the organic roots of the economy or something. There is a dark side to that, which is, of course, discrimination on platforms like Airbnb is rife. And I think it's not too strong to say that maybe they don't encourage it, but they really permit it in the way that, for example, the hosts on Airbnb, you see a picture of the host. And we've got very good evidence now that if the host happens to be black or the guest happens to be black, they don't get as many bookings. They get bookings cancelled, turned down at the last minute. And in trying to encourage people to think about it as a very personal transaction, Airbnb create this discrimination that you just wouldn't get at a hotel. There's no way the Hilton would look at your photo and go, the wrong race. We won't be taking your reservation. But very easy on Airbnb. So, I love to think about the miracle of trust in a modern economy, the way that we all cooperate together. We take it completely for granted, but the idea that we're not just like chimpanzees beating each other to death constantly in the street and stealing each other's stuff, it's amazing. But it's easy to take for granted the fact that some people are trusted more than others, even though they don't deserve to be trusted more than others.
That comes across very strongly in the book. And there's a very strong feminist message in the book, actually, a lot. That the fact that half the workforce are, depending on where you are in the globe, either criminally undervalued or marginally undervalued. And how does that and also you obviously talk about migration being a force for economic good. And how ludicrous it is that those people should be kept out, when in fact they're with the inclusion of women and those from all around the globe, the globalization actually can only help drive economics in a positive direction.
Yeah, the initial passport system was to prevent people leaving. Like, we've got valuable workers, we don't want them walking out of town, so we institute a passport system. We stop. I just think that's
it's something I never ever knew about passports, that they were as you say a device to stay. Stay, for God's sake. And as you say, and you write about passports as included as one of your 50, but perhaps we'd have been better off if they hadn't re-emerged after their disappearance at the end of the Second World War.
Yeah, the First World War. The late 19th century, it looked like everyone was kind of getting bored of them, and they're just a bit of a faff, and who needs them? And then after the war, they came back with a vengeance, and the League of Nations agreed the standard format, and they're absolutely taken for granted these days.
And yet they've become these sort of iconic signifiers, haven't they? I mean, particularly at the moment. I mean, we are
burgundy passport or a blue one.
I know, and the blue passport has been this sort of almost like a sword that's been brandished by leavers, and yet. That couldn't be more of a symbol of exclusion, really.
Yeah, it is ironic, the idea of like this is the way we identify our tribe and keep people out. But there we go. I'm encouraged that you think that the book has a feminist angle.
Oh, most definitely. I mean, it both implicitly and explicitly. Of course, most explicitly would be the chapter that you write about the pill, and. That would certainly feature in my top 50. And obviously, it liberated women. It allowed women to go to work without the constant fear that they were going to get pregnant. It's a much safer method of contraception. The thing that really stuck in my mind about that chapter, I talked to my partner about it and we couldn't get over it, was the fact that Casanova's preferred contraceptive technique was half a lemon used as a cervical cap.
Yeah.
And that, I still can't get over that. I can't move beyond it in any way.
Yeah, I mean... There were
half a lemon. That's an own goal. I mean, we were trying to work out who it would hurt. I mean, nobody wins in that scenario. Nobody wins.
I mean, I wasn't there. That's just what the legend is, that's what he used. But there you go. But also horse dung was another one. That doesn't seem like a good idea either.
Well, I mean, the bacteriologist would have plenty to say about it, but yeah.
But yeah, well, it turns out it's quite difficult to not have babies. So
yes, tortoiseshell. I mean, they used to use tortoiseshell condoms.
Yeah, that's got to... Yeah.
Awful! Yeah. Awful! But the fact that you could have something that, A, wasn't painful or compromised your health.
Yeah.
And that would actually work.
Yeah, and was under the control of the woman. So you didn't have to negotiate over condom use or this sponges and caps, very messy, and you sort of plan ahead. Whereas with the pill, I mean, women were absolutely clamoring to get hold of it. What was interesting is that initially, I mean, it took over in the US, almost immediately was approved. It was embraced by married women as the contraceptive of choice. But they wouldn't let unmarried women have it because, well, why would you need it? And it took a while. And so this creates this fascinating natural experiment that was studied by Claudia Goldin, who's an amazing economist. She was president of the American Economic Association. She did this fantastic study of the adoption of the pill in the US. And because different states were differently repressive of women's rights at different times, you're able to plot, okay, now they're letting 21-year-olds have it. Now they're letting 18-year-olds have it. Now they're letting 16-year-olds have it. And the different sort of regimes. And it was happening in different states at different times. So that gives you a tool kit to say, well, what impact is it having? And the impact it seemed to have was basically women had already moved into further education and they were doing degrees, but they shifted towards these much longer professional degrees. So dentistry, medicine, law, MBAs.
So moving away from arts and humanities, so you're sort of three years.
Yeah, moved away from undergraduate degrees to the kind of degree that you have to stick with for 7 or 8 years. Yep. So it wasn't just like they moved into the sciences, it's that they moved into
professional
qualifications. And the Claudia Goldin's idea is, well, if you're in a situation where you don't have effective contraceptives, then if you want to be sexually active, you kind of have to get married. And even if you don't want to be sexually active, everyone else is getting married, so then you're going to get stuck. So people were marrying quite young and didn't have control over their fertility, and then the idea you're going to study for an 8-year degree and then do further study, and you won't really become paid properly until you're 30, by which time two kids have arrived. Very problematic. Because the contraceptive pill suddenly means you can stay sexually active, you don't have to get married, you got control of your fertility, everyone else is doing the same thing. So it's not that everyone's suddenly pairing off at the age of 22, everyone's waiting. And that suddenly makes the idea, well, hang on, I'm not going to become a mum until I'm 35. Much more practical. And women seem to have availed themselves of that by studying to be dentists, studying to be lawyers. And there were other things going on at the time, like the Vietnam War, which sent off all the male dentists and all the male doctors all of a sudden just got shipped off. But the timing of all of that isn't quite right. It's the timing of the adoption of the pill that seems to explain it. It's very interesting.
What's the Economist? You mentioned Trump. What's the Economist's view on Trump?
So I think the reason he's so disturbing to economists in particular, I mean, there are many reasons why he's disturbing to lots of right-thinking people, but the thing that disturbs economists is we tend to think of the world as being full of win-win situations. So things like trade, migration, these are all opportunities, collaboration in something such as NATO, all opportunities for everybody to be better off. We work together and we're better off. We trade with the Chinese, they get something, we get something, we're better off. That's just really fundamental to the way economists tend to see the world.
Everyone is a friend as opposed to anyone. Everyone is
annoyance. I like to look at people as friendly, but it's not so much that everyone's a friend. It's just that when we interact with each other, if we trade with each other, we may be friends, we may not be friends, but we're both benefiting. So we both benefit from trade. Trump's view is, there's a deal and someone wins the deal, someone loses the deal. That seems to be the way, maybe something to do with his reality TV persona, maybe something to do with his background in real estate. But he seems to view everything as kind of like a situation where the pie is fixed and I'm going to bully my way into a bigger slice of the pie. And you see that coming out all over the place in his negotiations with NATO, in his attitudes towards immigrants, in his attitude towards trade. I find a lot of it very distressing as a liberal-minded person. I'm internationalist in my outlook, and I think everybody has rights and everyone should be respected. But as an economist, what I find specifically distressing is this idea that, you know, there is no way to make the pie bigger. There is only a way for us to grab more of it. I think it's just fundamentally a misreading of the way the world is. But it can become self-fulfilling. And if you go into every relationship, every agreement, every meeting, thinking that whatever you can make the other person lose, you win, that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. I do worry about that.
I worry about the president who starts off cabinet meetings by asking people to go around and saying, you know, say something amazing about me for a minute. I mean,
there's something quite Stalinist about that, isn't there? Yes, you know, these stories about getting people to applaud, and the first person to stop applauding would sort of later be quietly dragged off to a gulag.
Although it has given me an idea for how I might run my next tour show.
there's a less brutal way of doing that. So one economist, I can't remember his name, one economist at the end of his economic lectures says, I will give $20 to the last person to stop applauding. But he will then leave a graduate student in charge of handing out the $20, because the applause goes on a long time. And basically people will applaud and then people will stop applauding. There'll be just a few people just stood there with their hands bleeding, not wanting to be the last person, not wanting to be the second last person to give up. So generally it ends up with two people just bloody-mindedly applauding for the $20. So you could let me know how it works out for you anyway.
This has absolutely revolutionised the way that I will go about my business. It's marvellous. Thanks for listening. As always, you can post reviews at Apple Podcasts. All the music in this episode was provided by Waiting for Smith. And if you want to check out more Waiting for Smith, then go to Spotify.
When the fountains all cease to flow, I'll be there if you want me to.
Hey everybody, this is Andy from No Such Thing as a Fish. We are a podcast made by the people who write QI, and every week we gather together with the four most crazy facts we've found out this week. So we have some examples of those for you now.
The telephone dialing code for Cape Canaveral is 321.
Ice hockey players have such muscly bottoms that they find it very hard to find jeans that fit.
I've got one. There are some species of wasp that are so small they are the same size as an amoeba.
Whoa.
Small wasps.
Amazing. And mine is that for the last 3 months of his life, having been shot, US President James Garfield had to eat everything through his bottom.
Oh, it's not all bottoms, though.
It's mostly bottoms. Okay, if you want to catch our podcast, check it out at nosuchthingasafish.com or look up No Such Thing as a Fish wherever you get your podcasts.